Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 13th of November. It's been a busy day in Washington. President-elect Donald Trump has visited the White House for the first time in nearly 4 years. His Republican Party has completed a clean sweep in Congress, and he has nominated some eyebrow-raising names for top jobs in his administration. We try to unpack what it all means for America and the world. We also get the latest on the fallout from Justin Welby's resignation. Consider what happens after someone caring for a partner with dementia dies, and at a time when Taramah Salata is in short supply, advice on a do-it-yourself dip. For now, still travelling on his own private Trump Force One rather than Air Force One, the US President-elect Donald Trump flew back to Washington today for his first visit to the White House since he reluctantly, very reluctantly, left it nearly 4 years ago. Waiting for him in front of a raging fire in the Oval Office, his successor, now also his predecessor, Joe Biden. Today, there were no nicknames, no comparison of golf handicaps, just the strained sound of what had been, before Donald Trump came along at least, standard protocol for a presidential transition.
Well, Mr. President-elect and the former president and Donald, congratulations. And looking forward to having a, like we said, smooth transition. Do everything we can to make sure you're accommodated, what you need. And we're going to get a chance to talk about some of that today.
So good.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. And politics is tough. And it's, in many cases, not a very nice world, but it is a nice world today. And I appreciate it very much. And a transition that's so smooth, it'll be as smooth as it can get. And I very much appreciate that, Jim.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
That world got even nicer for Donald Trump while he was in Washington, because shortly after his brief homecoming, his Republican Party was projected to have retained control of the US House of Representatives, completing a clean congressional sweep after the Republicans had previously gained a majority in the Senate. The only slight wrinkle for the Trump administration, his party's leader in the Senate will not be the president-elect's preferred candidate, but the senator from South Dakota, John Thune. Speaking shortly after his colleagues chose him in a secret ballot, the new Senate Majority Leader lumped his Democratic predecessor, Chuck Schumer, in with the current team in the White House.
It's a new day in the United States Senate, and it's a new day in America. The American people have loudly rejected the failed policies of the Biden-Harris-Schumer agenda. And this Republican team is united. We are on one team. We are excited to reclaim the majority and to get to work with our colleagues in the House to enact President Trump's agenda.
Well, joining us now from Washington, D.C., our correspondent, Anthony Zerka. Anthony, that White House meeting, a raging fire, not a sort of calming fire behind them. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, you know, it was almost, dare I say, normal. This is a tradition, having the incoming president meet with the outgoing president that has been honored for decades. Obviously, it was one that Donald Trump did not extend to Joe Biden 4 years ago. Donald Trump was still contesting the outcome of that 2020 election and resisted any kind of a normal transition process to the Democratic administration. But today they were saying all the right things and all the nice words. They had a meeting for 2 hours after that in private. And according to the Biden administration, Joe Biden did urge Donald Trump to continue to support Ukraine and advance other policies that are important to Joe Biden. But Donald Trump, after that meeting, did not trust the press. And we can imagine that he will do his own thing when he gets to power in just a matter of months.
Doing his own thing, yes, par for the course. But he learnt that, I think most people had expected it, that the House of Representatives is now projected to come under Republican control. Again, very narrowly, but it will retain control. His party will retain control of the House. So what does it mean for him that he will have all those levers of power under him?
It'll help him advance his agenda more easily. If Democrats had been in charge of the House of Representatives, Donald Trump would have had to compromise and would have had to back away from perhaps some of his more aggressive policy proposals. But with Republicans in control in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, it means there's going to be a much smoother process for enacting things like finding the funds to support mass deportation and increasing U.S. tariffs on foreign goods and cutting the budget in ways Donald Trump wants, all of these things, it will be much more likely with a Republican Congress throughout.
Smooth the process might be, but it's not the the word you'd associate with some of the appointments that he has announced in the last hour or so. I mean, let's just have a listen to one of them. His nominee for Attorney General, Congressman, is called Matt Gaetz. Here he is taking a jibe at pro-abortion women, as he called it, during a rally in 2022.
Our America is a pro-life nation, proudly. Have you watched these pro-abortion, pro-murder rallies? The people are just disgusting. Why is it that the women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions? Nobody wants to impregnate you if you look like a thumb.
Matt Gaetz there. Tell us a bit more about him, Anthony.
He is obviously a conservative firebrand, a very controversial figure in Congress. He has been under investigation from the House Ethics Committee. He was responsible for ousting the Republican Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, just last year, working with Democrats to knock him out of office, in part because of McCarthy's support of that ethics investigation. I remember I was at in the spin room after a Republican or a gubernatorial debate in Florida in 2018, and Matt Gaetz came into the spin room to defend the Republican candidate, almost got into a fist fight with a Democrat. He is very confrontational. He obviously is being advanced by Donald Trump because Donald Trump wants to take a hatchet to the U.S. Justice Department, which has investigated Donald Trump over the past 4 years. And even during Trump's presidency, the Justice Department put forth the independent counsel that investigated Trump and his contacts with the Russian government. So he's a vehicle, essentially, and a message of a shot across the bow to the Justice Department and to establishment Washington that Donald Trump is going to do things differently, and he's going to use people like Matt Gaetz to advance that agenda.
Anthony, thanks very much. Anthony Zerker there in Washington. Well, let's dig a little deeper into what Donald Trump's nominations for top jobs, including top foreign policy jobs, could mean for America and its role in the world. The Florida Senator, Marco Rubio, has, we've learnt tonight, been confirmed as the nominee, at least for the U.S. Secretary of State. He's amongst a number of the team that Donald Trump is assembling, known for taking a hard line towards Beijing. Speaking last year on Fox News, Senator Rubio outlined how he saw China.
So you see this alliance of countries that are starting to line up underneath this Chinese world order. It won't be identical to the Cold War, but I will just say China is a much bigger threat to America than the Soviet Union ever was to America or the world.
We're joined now by Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. He's just written an article for the New Statesman on the return of the Trump doctrine. Good evening, Professor.
Hi.
Let's start with Marco Rubio, nominee for America's top diplomat. What does that tell you about the Trump administration, the new Trump administration's approach towards foreign policy?
Well, he's been loyal to Trump after being an opponent of Trump earlier in Trump's political career. He's, as you heard, is a China hawk, but so are practically all of the people that are being appointed. But he's within the tradition of conservative Republicans. He's not an isolationist. You wouldn't associate him with that. He's somebody who actually Trump, in nominating him, said we'll be able to work with allies, and that's probably true. So he's not a particularly alarming choice for allies. There are others that have been appointed that will worry them more, but not particularly Rubio.
And being a China hawk has become something of a new normal, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the question is, what does that mean? Because the main thing it may mean is in the economic realm, because there we're going to see tariffs almost certainly pushed very high, and pressure to really take some of the sting out of Chinese strength by taking some of the sting out of its economy and protect U.S. jobs in the process. So there's that side of it. But if you then start to say, well, as Rubio was doing in your clip about the alliance that China is being said to put together, well, that includes Russia and Iran to a degree as well as North Korea. And of course, that takes you into Ukraine. So one of the issues that comes up is whether taking a hardline stance on China necessarily leads you into a hardline stance on Russia as well.
You say that Marco Rubio is not the most isolationist of the picks Donald Trump might have made. Does that then suggest that despite Donald Trump's isolationist tendencies, his foreign policy could be more nuanced?
I think it will be more nuanced. And the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, they're Trumpists. They're not going to be at odds with the things the president-elect has said, but they're people who can work the system. But some of the others, like, say, Tulsi Gabbard, who's just got a major intelligence role, is very much a non-interventionist and has been quite sympathetic to Russian positions in the past.
She's a former Democratic congresswoman. She ran for president, didn't she?
She did.
For the Democrats
she did
at one
indeed,
point.
Yeah. She, like Robert Kennedy Jr., was one who came over to Trump during the election year, and she's got her reward, assuming she gets confirmed by Congress.
Well, I want to ask you about that. What does she need to? What sort of hurdle does she need to overcome to do that?
Well, if a few Republican senators worry about some of her past positions and the fact that she used to be a Democrat, and that will include sympathy for Assad in Syria as well, then she could get into trouble. I think by and large, the Senate will want to give Trump the confirmations he's asked for. But there's a couple, including the new pick for the Pentagon as well, that I think are already raising eyebrows.
That's the Fox News anchor, isn't it, Pete Hogsett?
Yeah, who's got some military experience, but absolutely no experience in running a large organization, and is mainly put there because he objects to the Pentagon going woke, and not really got any sort of experience in managing, you know, the biggest organization in the world. So there'll be some fireworks, I think, around him as well, which will be basis of competence rather than his foreign policy.
So given this sort of patchwork of nominees, do you have one big takeaway from all of this about what we might see from a Trump White House?
I think we know the priorities, which go sort of deportation of immigrants, tariffs, China, Israel, Ukraine, Russia, more or less in that order. Whether international affairs gives him the answers he wants, because all of these cases require on other governments cooperating and working with the administration, well, we have to see. But I think we've got a pretty clear sense, and none of it surprising, of the new administration's priorities.
Lawrence Friedman, Professor of War Studies at King's College London, thanks very much. Well, tonight's a flurry of nominations to what are legacy government positions have followed hot on the heels of the eye-catching appointment of the world's richest man, Elon Musk, to co-lead a new Department of Government Efficiency. Well, cutting government waste is certainly a popular theme amongst Trump supporters like Rob Kinch, a farmer I met in rural Wisconsin in the run-up to last week's election.
My personal plan, if I was president of the United States right now, I would fire 50% of the federal employees. We don't need them all fussing over every little thing we do. That would cut the budget immensely. And when they figured out how to get by with half the employees they got now, I'd fire another half.
Well, Ryan Mack is a reporter for the New York Times. He's one of the authors of Character Limit, an account of Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, turning it, of course, into X. I asked him about how the tech billionaire's relationship with Donald Trump has changed.
2 years ago, he and Donald Trump were kind of at each other's throats in a way. You know, he was saying Donald Trump should sail into the sunset and not run for election again, you know, let the Republican Party move on. Donald Trump, on the other hand, said that Elon Musk was a con man, essentially, and a BS artist.
Quite an evolution from sailing off into the sunset to lead cheerleader. How on earth did that happen? What is it that has led to this transformation?
I think a few things, but largely this alienation by what he sees as the Democratic Party, essentially. He was turned off by the response to COVID in California, which was led by a Democratic governor. He was upset about his own daughter's transition. His daughter is trans. And he's also upset with the Biden administration in 2021 for not inviting him to this electric vehicle summit, which seems sort of childish in a way, but meant a lot to him. And this kind of all brewed together and led him to the feet of the Republican Party.
You've listed some of the policy or ideological reasons why he came on board the Trump team. But is there something else? And this is the world's richest man who started or led these incredibly successful companies. Is there something about him that has led him to want this position center stage?
Yeah, I mean, there's an incredible amount of business advantages and political advantages that he gets from supporting the president-elect and using nearly $200 million of his own money to push his campaign. You know, at the New York Times, we've calculated that Musk and his companies are under at least 20 federal investigations across various regulatory agencies. His companies take in billions of dollars in federal tax credits and contracts, whether that's at Tesla or SpaceX. And if you are now in the ear of the president-elect, soon to be president, or heading this so-called Department of Government Efficiency, you're going to have a lot of sway over those agencies that are supposedly looking at your companies and that spending.
And it's just insane. The SpaceX team can build a giant rocket faster than the government can move paperwork from one desk to another. This extreme overregulation where there's just new agencies being created every year, they're all doing the same thing, basically. So anyway, we got to stop this madness.
What about, I mean, you mentioned the name of this new department, sort of quasi department. We're not quite sure what it's going to be, do we? I mean, Department of Government Efficiency, the acronym DOGE, which obviously refers to the meme coin that he has championed. There's kind of humor there. There's something else going on as well, isn't there? And is that part of what Trump sees in this?
I don't know if Trump is so read into DOGE. This is very much an Elon move, you know, someone who is brain is steeped in online culture and who cooks for hours every day on the platform and likes to make these, frankly, you know, very teenage jokes.
I'm not just MAGA. I'm dark, gothic MAGA.
But to your point, we don't know what this thing is. I mean, in his statement last night, President-elect Donald Trump said that the agency is supposed to be outside of government, but it's supposed to provide advice and will partner with the White House and the Office of Management and Budget, which I don't know what that looks like. And I think a lot of people are kind of scratching their heads as to what this means.
Well, we know what Musk says his intention is, which is to radically slash government spending by trillions of dollars. I mean, how realistic is that?
The federal budget's around $6.5 trillion. He's been on the campaign trail even before this has been established, saying he's the efficiency king. He can bring about $2 trillion, he estimates, in cuts.
How much do you think we can rip out of this wasted $6.5 trillion Harris-Biden budget?
Well, I think we can do at least $2 trillion.
Yeah!
Yes.
$2 trillion.
That would be cutting into key services and, you know, spending that is needed in this country.
It's clear why a presidential candidate would want the world's richest man on board as he's running for office. But what do you think then is in it for Donald Trump now?
I think there is still a good association to be had if you tie your star to Elon Musk. You know, he is seen as a generational entrepreneur and has his own kind of built-in fan base. I think it remains to be seen how long that relationship will last and if there will be a burnout because, you know, Trump has tended to fall out with folks and he doesn't tend to like someone else calling the shots.
But at the moment, he's the one in the family photo. He's the one on the phone calls with President Zelensky. He's very much in the room, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He is the one on Trump's airplane heading to the White House today. And he is, as one Trump family member said, you know, basically a part of the family.
That was the author Ryan Mack, who wrote Character Limit about Elon Musk. And coming up later on The World Tonight, as some shoppers express an outcry at the shortage of tarama salata from supermarket shelves, someone, Jay Rayner, will be on hand with a DIY solution. Well, now we're going to look ahead to tomorrow, because the Chancellor will be unveiling plans for a big pensions shake-up. Rachel Reeves wants to create pension mega funds designed to help unlock billions of pounds in investment for in businesses and infrastructure. To tell us a bit more, the person to whom she has been outlining her plans, our economics editor, Faisal Islam. So tell us more, Faisal.
This is an idea that's been around, not least been around the world. I mean, let's just sort of step back a second. We often do stories where we say this water company, this energy company, this port, this shopping centre is owned by the Canadian teachers or the Australian professors. And it's always struck me as, you know, sort of think, well, how's that happened? How have they managed to kind of buy up infrastructure around the world? And the answer is that they consolidated their pensions funds, you know, for public sector workers, into these giant vehicles. And they go around shopping around the world, and they also invest in high-tech industries. Rachel Reeves has seen this and admired this for years and now wants it for Britain. And wants it for Britain, not just in the sense of going around the world, but just wonders why British pension funds don't do the same in Britain. And so the main sort of vehicle for this is the local government pension scheme. It's worth about £360 billion, got 6 million or so members. And it's currently split up into 86 individually managed funds. They're going to pass legislation that consolidates that into 8 mega funds that has the capacity, the skills, the sort of risk balancing to make these bigger investments that we have sort of outsourced to the public pension funds of other nations. So that's the general plan. And, you know, clearly it might affect the members of that pension scheme. But her hope is that it's one of the keys to unlock significantly bigger growth, because you get more money into infrastructure. But critically, and there may be a criticism here that it's trying to do too much with one policy. There's a big sort of valley of death, if you like, for our another old story about the British economy, which is that we have all the inventions, but we don't turn them into the mega companies, the Microsofts and the Googles. And that's because when an invention is kind of secure and shown to work and to function or to have efficacy in terms of pharmaceutical companies, then you need £1 billion or so. And that is just the sort of investment that you don't get in Britain. So many of these companies end up moving to America primarily. So that is what she says she's trying to address. It's a big bang major reform. It's quite interesting. It leans on what's happening internationally. There's a bit of pushback from the industry. Interestingly, Jeremy Hunt was trying to do some of the same, but didn't quite get it legislated. And that is her major landmark reform in this very important speech, the Mansion House speech to financiers in the city tomorrow. But we will also hear other narratives. I think, you know, 2 weeks after this big tax and spend budget, there is also, we've seen the concern, haven't we, from retail bosses, from hospitality bosses, about having to foot the national insurance bill. There was also a critique about, you know, where's the growth in this, in that budget for growth? This will, I think, will start to answer that with this big bang reform in pensions. And then I think the other theme we're going to get, which is obvious where you've just been talking about it, where this is aimed at, which is a plea for free trade in the world. And she told me in this interview in her lab coat at some of the Imperial College spin-outs, she told me that she could work in partnership with the new Trump government to ensure trade flows continue, and that she'd be making strong representations to the new Trump administration.
Faisal, many thanks for that briefing, Faisal. Islam there. Now, what happens when the partner of somebody with dementia dies? It's a question that has accompanied the many tributes to Timothy West after his family shared the news that the much-loved actor had died peacefully in his sleep at the age of 90. He was also, as well as an actor, the writer and the star of his own love story, his 61-year marriage to fellow actor Prunella Scales. Their relationship took on a different dimension after she was diagnosed with vascular dementia. And they spoke openly and movingly about those changed circumstances on the Today programme last year.
We've managed pretty well, really. I don't think we ever think, oh, no, come on, move.
No, I don't, not ever. I've been asked to live for the rest of my life with somebody I respect very much and I quite admire and agree with about a lot of things and argue with about a lot of things quite happily, you know. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for sticking me for so long.
Well, we've done all right, yeah.
I think
we've managed.
Very good of him to have stuck me for so long.
Well, yeah, it had its moments.
Still a lump in the throat when you hear that, isn't it? Timothy West, of course, had spoken about his fears for his wife if he died before she did. You can speak now to Alison Littleford, Ambassador for Alzheimer's Research UK. Her husband, Frank, who was diagnosed with dementia in 2020, has just celebrated his 80th birthday. Good evening, Alison.
Good evening. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
And when you heard that little clip of Timothy West and Prunella Scales, what did you think?
It was very poignant, and it made me think about my own situation and the situation of many people I have met who are caring for people living with dementia. I think worrying about my own health and what may happen to me if I'm ill is always there in the back of my mind.
When you're focused on the caring, do you have to try and put it to one side, though?
Yes, I do, because the caring is a 24-hour role for me. My husband, Frank, is now very dependent on me for everything, and he's not able to do anything very much for himself independently. So I have to focus on caring for him and making sure that he's safe and as well as he can be.
It's clearly a tough thing to watch your loved one go through this change. But, I mean, for you, have you adjusted? For you, is it just another stage in your relationship, in your life?
We've been very fortunate. We've had a very good relationship for 40 years. But inevitably, that is very different now. It's no longer an equal relationship. And, yes, I've had to adjust and take responsibility for everything and become Frank's carer.
And separately to the Alzheimer's diagnosis, he's also been treated for cancer, hasn't he? That must make things doubly difficult for you.
Yes, he was treated for cancer in 2015 for prostate cancer, which fortunately was very successful. But that was dealt with. He was treated and is now well, as far as that's concerned. The dementia is a very different thing in that he is slowly deteriorating. His understanding of things and his ability to make sense of things and to do things is deteriorating every day.
You talk about your worry for what happens if you're no longer there to look after him. Timothy West, before he died, says, "If I go first, the services that we don't use at the moment will probably look after her, but on my own, I don't think I'd want to stay."
Yes. If I became ill or if I died and if anything happened to me, Frank would not be able to live independently at all. So yes, he would have to go into residential care to make sure that he was cared for and was safe. And I think that's a really another good reason why we really need to fund research and find a cure as quickly as possible for the diseases that cause dementia.
Well, you're certainly doing your bit, and we really appreciate you coming on the programme and talking to us. Alison Littleford, Ambassador there for Alzheimer's Research UK. Now, a day after the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, resigned over his handling of a serial abuser who ran Christian summer camps, the shockwaves are still reverberating through the Church of England. Victims of the abuser, John Smythe, who died 6 years ago, have been meeting senior church leaders today to discuss the way forward. Our religion editor, Aleem McBull, is with me now. So, Aleem, 24 hours or so for the church to reflect on Justin Welby's decision. What is the mood in the church at the moment?
Well, you described it very well in terms of there being shockwaves. It's been an extremely bruising week, actually, I mean, since this report landed. The report itself, of course, is devastating in its description of the abuse of more than 120 boys over nearly 50 years. That in itself was bruising. And then the levels of responsibility of those who knew as far back as 1982, and even the current leadership. So we've had the resignation, of course, of Archbishop Justin Welby yesterday. And since then, there has been some focus on some of the other serving clergy. There are many clergy over the years who have got huge questions to answer. The report even says there was an active cover-up in the 1980s. But in terms of those who are still in their positions, they include the current Bishop of Lincoln, Stephen Conway, who has also now acknowledged that he should have done more. He received reports of abuse by Smythe. He did pass them on to Justin Welby. He was the one who passed them on in 2013, but he now says he should have pursued that further. Another bishop, Martin Seeley, was in a selection interview when Smythe's abuse was apparently mentioned to him, though he says he doesn't remember. Tamo Magoba is the Archbishop of Cape Town. That's where John Smythe moved to at one point. He was also told in a letter. And then there was Bishop Jo Bailey Wells. She was briefed on some of this abuse in 2013 when she was chaplain to Justin Welby. And I've been speaking to her husband, Sam Wells, who is a prominent a cleric. He's the vicar at St Martin in the Fields in London. And I spoke to him. He's been very upset by the clamour for heads to roll. So I asked how he's felt about the way things have panned out.
I think the overall theme is powerlessness. What can you do? The person at the centre of this story is dead. There isn't a criminal process, which would usually be the channel for such anger. Something must be done, if you like, with capital letters. But what actually that is, that thing that must be done is very difficult to identify. And so almost inevitably, the natural response is to point the finger and say, who is the person who is most responsible for this? And that's exactly what's happened.
When I was talking about this clamour for heads to roll, it wasn't just for Justin Welby. It's now moved on to others, named varying degrees of association with the case in the report, including your wife. But how do you feel about that?
The truth is, the pain that the survivors experience, and those who identify with their experience, may have had pain of their own from different quarters, or may be profoundly concerned about this issue for all the right reasons. The things those people most desperately want are not things they can get. They're to undo all the dreadful things. Forgiveness means letting go of the idea that we can have a better past. It's very difficult to come to terms with the things that have happened. It's natural to seek recompense in some form, whether monetary, whether practical, or whether in terms of pointing the finger at people who should have done things differently. I think that's perfectly natural. I don't think that necessarily brings the healing and the peace that in the heat of the moment we often think it will. Clearly, where people have been absolutely unambiguously in the wrong, they need to be held to account for that. But we need to be careful of our instinctive urge in our anger and our fury and frustration, completely understandable, to do things that actually continue to compound and extend the problem rather than make changes and then seek to find peace.
Aleem, many thanks. Our religion editor, Lee McBull there. A dip in supply, not a Greek tragedy. Newspaper headline writers have been having a rather better time today than fans of the fish roe dip Tarama salata, which has disappeared from supermarket shelves following a strike at one of the biggest companies that supplies it. But you don't have to say ta-ra to Tarama, because help is at hand in the familiar form of restaurant critic and broadcaster Jay Rayner. In his new book, Nights Out at Home, he not only writes about the recent enthusiasm for Tarama salata on British restaurant menus, but he also includes a recipe if you want to make it at home. And he's in our homes now because he's joining us on the line. Good evening, Jay.
Evening.
So tell us about the fashion, if you like, for Tarama salata. Why has it become so popular?
Well, it went through a phase where you would find it essentially in Britain's Greek restaurants, which were essentially Greek Cypriot. And it was kept there, and those of us who are surnate will remember it as being very pink, usually as a result of beetroot extract or whisperit cochineal, which was an extract made from beetles. And then around about 2005 to 2008, chefs started rediscovering it, and it would turn up, it would be called whipped cod's roe, because they wanted to put some distance between themselves and the tarama that we knew of old. And it did tend to be less acidic and slightly creamier. And certainly less pink. And I'd see it in places like Launceston Place and Clematt in Manchester, and it would always be inventively used. But what's interesting is that over the recent times, they've gone back to calling it what it is, Taran Masalata, that famed, particularly Greek Cypriot dip made with cod's roe, smoked cod's roe, and various additions depending on which tradition you come from.
Now, to the point at hand, which is it ain't there at the moment on the shelves, so we need someone like you to give some advice on how to do it at home.
Well, one of the interesting things is we eat a lot of it, and a lot of it turns up in our corner shops. But the actual main ingredient, smoked cod's roe, is not brilliantly easy to get hold of. You will need to go generally to an independent fishmonger's who has smoked fish. The rest of it is pretty straightforward. It comes in lozenges inside a membrane. It'll be a deep orange color. You scrape out the roe into a blitzer, a food processor. My volumes are 250 grams of smoked cod's roe with about 175 grams of creme fraiche. If you want it creamier, use double cream. And then you are seasoning it up with lemon juice and cracked black pepper and blitzing it and tasting all the time till you get something you like. There are other ways. Other people will say you make it with water, or you can make it with a mixture of vegetable oil and cream. It's a matter of taste, a matter of tradition, a matter of where you come from. I am not Greek Cypriot, it has to be said. So these are things that I've invented in my kitchen after eating an awful lot of the stuff in various restaurants.
And eat it with what? Always pitta?
No, you can eat it with anything, actually. One of the reasons it ended up in my book was a great dish in a restaurant in Glasgow called Gloriosa, where a chef called Rosie Healy partnered it with radishes, with radish tops and boiled eggs with soft jammy yolks. And I just thought that was a fabulous collection of things. And so it turns up in my book, inspired by Rosie Healy's dish. And it goes very well. But really, anything you can dip, anything you can dredge, you can put through Taran Masalata.
Jay, thanks very much. Nights Out at Home is the book if you want to look in more detail. Jay Rayner, restaurant critic there. That is The World Tonight. I'm James Kamara-Sami. From all of us here, have a very good night.